The consensus view for much of this year has been that the U.S. would see a soft landing versus an outright recession. However, there's been a slight shift to that conviction in recent weeks. To discuss the current market and economic outlook with us today is Simon White. He is a macro strategist at Bloomberg LP, also co-founder of the institutional research firm Variant Perception. Simon, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So we're going to have some charts that are posted where this interview is located at Financial Sense that we're going to go through. So I want to encourage all of you listening to refer to these charts. But let's talk about this idea of soft landing versus hard landing, and what's your take on where things are at currently?
Good starting question, Chris, because obviously that's something that has been going around interminably. That markets are always quite interesting. You know, they jump from one thing to another quite quickly. And over the last 2 or 3 months, it's been what sort of landing scenario that we're going to have, from whether it's soft or no landing or a hard landing. I'd also say that there's almost a way that everyone can be right, because none of these things are like have hard definitions attached to them. Although I think, you know, if we have a hard landing, it's probably going to be pretty clear. But as I'll get into, even then, I think when it comes to recessions, they're not clearly defined. I tend to use the arbiter being the NBER, and they obviously give some guidelines about how they define a recession. But of course, it's not a clear cut thing. And I think really to try and understand more fully about how economies work, a really good way to do that is to understand how recessions work. So I've kind of looked into this over the years in a lot of detail, and where we are, I'll get to where we are right now, but just sort of standing back. Recessions are really, if you like, nonlinear shifts in economies. So economies are you know, they don't go in a smooth way from a non-recessionary to a recessionary state. They go in a very unsmooth and highly nonlinear way. And the reason behind that really is the interaction between hard and soft data. So soft data is market data, survey data, things like ISM, consumer confidence. And hard data is really things like industrial production, retail sales, things like that. And recessions tend to happen when you get both of these hard data and soft data becoming stressed at the same time. And the linkage really is what happens is, if you look at the chart on page 2 on the slides, you can see it quite clearly. You actually often get spikes in soft data stress quite regularly. But they turn into nothing, as in they don't turn into recession. And they only turn into recession when you get the hard data stress as well. And then you get essentially a feedback loop. So you have soft data stress, so the market survey data starts to deteriorate. And then if that bleeds into hard data, you can get this feedback loop developing, where then markets start to concentrate on weakening hard data. And then that feeds back into the soft data. And then you get a cascading effect. And then very quickly, you can get a recession developing. And that's a real key point, I think, that's misunderstood about recessions, or not appreciated until it's too late, is that they're very sudden. So there's the three P's of recessions. You know, they're pronounced, pervasive, and protracted. And you could add in a fourth P as well, that they are precipitate. And as I say, they tend to happen at a time when most people think that the danger is over. And then they very quickly occur. So where we are today, as you can see from the chart on page 2, the right-hand chart, is that both hard data and soft data are currently stressed and above a threshold that has normally led to recession. And that obviously doesn't mean, you know, definitely 100% there will be one. But this, along with a number of other things that you can look at, are consistent with a recession. And obviously the cycle is difficult because a lot has happened that's been very unusual over the last 3 years. I think that doesn't mean that the old relationships are dead in the water. I think it has meant that things are operating in slightly different sequences, which means the timings are going to be a little bit odd than normal. But I wouldn't kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater with a lot of very robust relationships that have worked over many years. So, you know, if we have this interaction, this cascading effect, then you could see that very rapidly turn into a recession. And if you look at a number of other measures, for instance, GDI, is already consistent with a recession. Another very good indicator, if you look at state claims, so unemployment claims. Now, this is where it gets very interesting, because the pervasive part of a recession, it tends to happen in lots of places at the same time. So if you look at claims data by US state, and you look at how many of them are deteriorating at the same time, that also is above a threshold that has previously been consistent with a recession. The same for continuing claims. And also, so the final point I think is really important to make about why recessions seem to happen abruptly is that often people are kind of flying using revised data. So the data that you tend to see now in real time is typically revised, but here's the kind of kicker, is the revisions tend to be the biggest at turning points like recessions. So you often find that the data is most wrong just going into recession. So I would say, based on where we are today, that a recession is still more likely than not. Most, as I say, of the indicators that I follow are saying that a recession is very close to imminent, but we won't know until after the fact. And then I'd say the next most important thing as an investor is, you know, it's quite academic talking about recessions. You know, what does this mean for stocks? And what does this mean for bonds? And that's something we can get into as well, if you want, later in the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll touch upon that. But, you know, as you said, recessions happen when hard and soft data weaken at the same time. We do see that currently. And you show that with one of the charts that we're going to have posted along with this interview. We did not necessarily see that, you know, after 2020. We were seeing soft data stress, but the hard data was tending to remain firm. But now we see both of those weakening. And also we have inflationary pressures somewhat reemerging as well, with higher oil and gas prices. As you said, the recession risk is more than likely when you look at the various data points that you review. Where do you think the consensus is on that, though? It seems like there has been a slight shift in the consensus view, especially when you think about some of the recent market turbulence and what happened with the Fed meeting recently. But would you say that the consensus is appreciating the recession risks currently?
I think they are probably underappreciating them. And there's a number of kind of ways you can kind of, it's obviously hard to really gauge, you know, sentiment unless you know people's positioning. You know, what's the old adage? Don't listen to what people say, watch what they do. But you can look at, you know, basic things, for instance, searches and news for no landing or soft landing versus hard landing. There seems to be a lot more focus on soft landing right now. And I'd say the way the market is trading, you know, the stock market isn't really trading in a way that is consistent with a recession. The stock market does tend to sell off before a recession, but not as much as you might think, and then continue selling off through the recession, but it tends to bottom before the recession ends and then starts rallying. But if you look at, say, you know, the median behavior of the stock market around recessions, and you look at today what the, you know, what the market's doing today, it's not really consistent. It's not kind of sold off. It's still basically consistent with the outcome is that we don't get a recession. So I very much think that a recession would still catch a lot of people unawares. But I think the other thing to appreciate is that this wouldn't be the sort of recessions that people are used to, right? This is not going to be a garden variety recession. You know, one of my views, again, we can touch upon it in more detail, why is I think that we're in an inflationary regime. And as much as inflation has come back down, you know, a reasonable amount from its peak, I think essentially it's going to boomerang higher again, not necessarily new peaks, but I think it's going to see a second rise. And I think therefore this recession will be accompanied by elevated inflation. And that's not something we've really seen for the last like three decades. So that means that I don't think that stocks and bonds will necessarily do what they normally do in one of these more garden variety recessions. And that's, again, I don't think people have adjusted their playbooks. I mean, that's really one of my kind of overarching points that I've been trying to make in my columns, is that recency bias is still really plaguing people and what they expect to happen. You know, I think inflation is is a huge game changer. It literally changes almost every kind of axiom or canonical kind of law of markets that I think anyone around right now is taken for granted as a rule of thumb. So it really kind of is going to upset the apple cart. So, you know, when the next recession comes, people might think actually their stocks haven't fallen that much, but they'll still be living in a nominal world. You know, stocks will tend to do much worse in real terms, but people are more likely to still adhere to thinking in nominal terms because they're not used to an elevated inflation. And similarly with bonds, you know, bonds will not unlikely to be the same recession hedge that they are. I mean, in a normal environment, as in a non-inflationary environment, the Phillips curve, you know, that's essentially the negative relationship between unemployment and inflation, you tend to get this kind of fairly stable linear Phillips curve relationship. But in an inflationary regime, the Phillips curve becomes non-linear and unstable. And that's kind of where we are now. And again, this is another really key point. You know, one of the most important ratios in finance is the stock bond ratio. And really, we're watching this break down right now. They are now correlated positively. For the last two decades, they've been mostly correlated negatively. And so therefore, when you get a growth shock, people expect, again, recency bias, bonds to be a recession hedge because they should do the opposite thing. But if the growth shock is accompanied by an inflationary shock, then both bonds and stocks will fall together. And I think that's another reason to suspect that people really haven't hugely changed, you know, their portfolio construction to take account of the new regime we're in. Maybe we're seeing some very tiny hints of it at the minute. Term premium has been beginning to rise. So that's, you know, one of the things that's been driving bond yields higher. But I think we're just very far off people really changing their mindset for what an inflationary regime means for markets and the economy.
Yeah, and it seems that that's been a slight shift more recently, especially in recent weeks. I mean, we have seen, again, oil prices back up towards $90 a barrel. So that's playing a role in this. And then there's the whole higher for longer mantra now with the belief that, of course, the Fed is going to have to either raise rates again, perhaps one more time. But given what you said, it sounds like that investors are not appreciating the upside risk for inflation persisting for longer than what they've seen over the past decades, and especially if we think about the Fed itself also getting the transitory thesis wrong after the post-2020 collapse, you know, saying that inflation was transitory. But you're saying, you know, the upside for inflation is likely to be with us here for longer. And you have a chart here. We definitely need to touch upon this, but looking at oil prices and some leading indicators for oil. So can you tell us about where oil and global food prices fit into your larger macro outlook here?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think these are two very interesting sort of manifestations of why, you know, I think inflation is showing early signs of coming back. But just to stand back a little bit, I think it's underappreciated really what has driven inflation lower so far. So inflation peaked in the US last June, just over 9%. And now I think we're down back around, you know, somewhere in the 3 handle. But the San Francisco Fed break up core PCE inflation into acyclical and cyclical components. So the cyclical components are all the components of PCE that have essentially a high correlation with Fed policy. And acyclical components are everything that's left over. And this is really interesting, is if you look at the two of them, almost all the decline in core PCE, and a lot of that obviously feeds into the headline number as well, has been driven by acyclical inflation. And really what that's saying is that the Fed has had very little direct impact on bringing inflation down so far. So after, you know, all these 500 basis points plus of rate hikes, the direct effect that they've had on inflation is actually probably fairly minimal quite far. And all you have to do is look at slack in the labor market. And that's the transmission mechanism that the Fed is supposed to go through to try and bring inflation down. You know, we know that we've still got very low slack in labor markets. Now that leads on to what has been driving inflation down. Well, if you look at the cyclical component, it pretty much matches PPI in China. Extremely close relationship, leading relationship. So PPI in China leads the acyclical component of core PCE. And that, I think, is a big reason why inflation has not thus far come back. It's the inflation has fallen despite the Fed, not because of the Fed. But that obviously means that if Fed policy is not as effective as it was, and there'll be some delayed impact, we know obviously the long and variable lags with monetary policy, but if the other parts of inflation start to come back before really Fed policy has had much of an impact, if indeed it has, it's going to have a big as impact as people expect it to, that will then feed back into the other portion of inflation and inflation would begin to rise again. But we're seeing that in other ways too. And that's why you look at the oil price. So oil, you know, everybody hated oil back in the summer. You know, sentiment was extremely negative, but excess liquidity had been turning higher. Now, there's lots of different ways of looking at liquidity, but I prefer to look at excess liquidity. And that's the difference between real money growth and economic growth. And it's quite an intuitive measure. Not only is it empirically lead risk assets like things like oil, it kind of makes a lot of sense because, you know, money is created by banks and by central banks. And what isn't used up by the needs of the real economy is essentially excess and tends to find its way into risk assets. So that began turning up in kind of March, April time. And at a time when people were pretty, you know, negative overall. I mean, it's kind of an inherently contrarian indicator because it tends to be rising when you know people are actually quite negative. And inflation is a kind of lagging indicator. So inflation was falling, and growth was still quite low, and that ultimately meant that excess liquidity started to rise. So that pointed to not only to higher oil prices, but it pointed to higher equity prices as well. And obviously, over most of the last, you know, 6 to 9 months, or sorry, 3 to 6 months, we've had pretty buoyant time for risk assets, and the food prices as well is again another manifestation. Food prices, global food prices themselves tend to have a pretty good leading relationship with U.S. inflation. So I think from a structural standpoint, as in Fed policy has probably not had as much of a direct impact as is widely believed. And the fact that when China kind of gets back on stream, which I think it will, I don't think we're at that stage yet where it is going to hit its deflationary kind of black hole and doesn't come back. I think they still have a couple of cards to play. So you'll start to see growth and stimulus and inflation return there. And that will ultimately feed back into, you know, inflation in the US when at a time when people are expecting it to. You know, you look at CPI fixing swap markets, it's certainly not expected to reaccelerate. So I think that will catch people unawares. And a big part of this is timing as well. Like I don't think this is necessarily going to happen by the end of the year. This could be something that is at some point over the first half of next year. But in the interim period, we could still see growth slow down much faster than inflation takes off. And that puts the Fed in a sort of tricky situation. So we could end up, you know, with the Fed, you know, unlikely it's going to cut in the near term, but really kind of pulling back in this higher for longer thing more than again, than people expect, because the growth deteriorates, but the inflation has not come back. But then, you know, the likelihood is, as I say, you get into next year and that then begins to change again because we see inflation reaccelerating.
Well, it's very interesting, too, because, I mean, think about it. If you look back at the 70s, we saw subsequent waves of inflation. You know, there's a first wave and then a second wave and even really a third wave if you look at the sticky price of inflation. So it sounds like, you know, we've seen that first wave post-COVID crash with a lot of the stimulus, the supply chain problems getting up to 9.1% at the highs. It's decelerated, but perhaps we're in that troughing or basing phase before another reacceleration in inflation. Like you said, it may not go back to the same highs that we saw before at 9.1, but even just any type of reacceleration from current levels would be putting more pressure on the Fed to stay at this higher for longer, and of course on the economy and markets as well. Is that kind of the view that you're giving here?
Yeah, Exactly. And I think the curve's kind of interesting because it's not obviously just about what the Fed does, it's what the market thinks the Fed will do. And obviously, for most of this cycle, the market has been saying when the Fed goes higher for longer, it's like, okay, we'll give you higher, but we're not giving you longer. And if you look at like the SOFR curve or the Fed funds curve, you know, the peak would rise, you know, kind of as it had to, because, you know, the Fed was kept raising rates. But the pivot would remain, if you like, that sort of cut priced into later dated stuff. Now, that's started to come up again, you know, that as the Fed has kind of pressed its assertion again on this higher for longer thing. But I think that we're getting to the limits of how far that can go. And even if the Fed holds at the front and the growth data starts to weaken, or we very quickly look like we're going into a recessionary scenario, you know, the Fed will hold for as long as it can, so it doesn't lose any credibility that it's just weakening on one bit of bad growth data or, you know, a hint of a recession. But the SOFR curve should start to, you know, reinvert again quite quickly, I would say, as the market basically says, you know, the Fed is going to have to go at some point.
You know, when we were talking about the consensus view and the fact that they're probably not appreciating the recession risks here currently, part of that has to do with, like you said, with recency bias and thinking that, you know, inflation is going to return back to normal, that we're going to get back to that, you know, 2% range or so. And that's not the environment that we're probably looking at here, especially given what you outlined and some of these charts that you're discussing. We also have the view that investors should be prepared for higher than average inflation for the long term, whether or not that's, you know, in that 3-4% range or even getting back as high as 5%. It's hard to say exactly, but I don't think we're going to be remaining in that 2% for the long term, you know, in the years ahead. You know, that being said, you do have something that I think is important when it does come to understanding where the consensus may be not pricing in things correctly, and that's looking at credit spreads. And this is one of the charts that you have here. Can you tell us about what you're seeing with the credit markets and where things may be either mispriced or, you know, where there's a disconnect?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's credit is, you know, really intriguing right now because it just, again, like a lot of things, isn't really behaving in the way it normally does. And, you know, there's a number of potential reasons for that, which I can get into. But standing back, you know, I was trying to figure out like, okay, why, you know, why is it that credit spreads perhaps are, you know, not really reflective of some of the other things that I was seeing in credit markets? I mean, normally, for instance, you know, when banks are tightening credit conditions, that tends to coincide with, you know, rising credit spreads. And, you know, we weren't really seeing that. Banks were tightening conditions, but you know, high yield spreads remained quite contained. Another really kind of eye-opening one, which we have the chart there on page 5 on the right-hand side, is you can track bankruptcy filings. So that's something that Bloomberg tracks, I think, from court filings. They look at any company in the US with, I think, liabilities of over $50 million and then count, you know, how many there are. And then that tends to lead Chapter 11, so when things actually, I guess, officially go into bankruptcy. But what's really interesting is if you look at that bankruptcy filings graph with credit spreads, that they've completely kind of disjointed. So they tend to move fairly closely together. And when you get spikes, which you see at recessions, you know, both tend to move up together. But this time around, you know, we've had this spike in bankruptcy filings, and that really hasn't been matched at all by, you know, particularly big rise at all in high yield credit spreads. So I was trying to figure out, you know, what might be behind this. And, you know, one relationship that I'm sure a lot of people are aware of, you look at high yield spreads and the VIX, they tend to move very, very closely. And, it, you know, there's a kind of makes sense, you know, that they're quite close to each other on the capital structure. You know, equity is just essentially a sliver of capital between assets and liabilities. So when the capital structure gets stressed, you know, the equity has to bear a lot of the brunt of that. And so the you know, equity volatility tends to rise. And given high yield spreads or, you know, just, a, you know, high yield debt, sorry, are just a little bit above, they tend to feel that stress too. But there's actually a more direct linkage too, because, you know, in terms of how do people model credit spreads, well, one of the ways you model credit spreads is using the Merton distance to default model. The way that works is you assume that the equity is a perpetual call option on the solvency of a firm. And you take the equity implied volatility, essentially the VIX, as an input, and then you use black holes, and then you spit out something that you can't observe, which is the volatility of the asset base. And so that is essentially used to help price credit spreads. So VIX has been very low. And then you know, the reasons, and there's been a lot of discussion about this, why is the VIX so low? There's a, you know, there's a number of reasons. Implied correlations have been very low. And that's perhaps due to the sort of narrowness of the rally we've had. Obviously, we've had this AI-driven rally. So I think that's kind of driven implied correlations down, and that tends to mean implied volatility is also lower. And also, we've just had massive option speculation, you know, so hedging from option dealers, you know, gamma trading. I think that's also repressed the VIX. So you have a very low VIX that maybe is not, well, it is what it is, of course, but it's not necessarily reflective of where credit markets are. And so that's why I think you've ended up with that disconnect. But that sort of means that credit spreads are not really representative anymore of maybe what's actually happening in credit markets. And that's further obscured by the massive rise of credit, private credit markets. So the private credit market in the US is now something like $1.5 trillion, you know, all sorts of leveraged loans and NAV loans and things like that. And I think that's obscuring price discovery. So my concern really is that on the surface, you know, credit might look okay if you just happen to be looking at things like high yield spreads. But under the surface, things are likely, you know, much worse or reasonably amount worse than credit spreads would betray. So that's certainly a risk that, again, I don't think is properly appreciated, because people just don't really have visibility on the credit market as they did before. And that would be another way, if you like, that a recession could happen quickly rather than slowly, would be suddenly a lot of the kind of underlying pain in credit spreads manifests itself, and people realize that the credit markets are actually a lot worse than people think they are. And that would be, I'd say, one way. You know, right now I don't see a deep recession, but I'd say that would be the major risk if a mild recession maybe would return into a much deeper recession, is if the credit markets are considerably worse than maybe anybody thinks. And I think that would have the potential to really drive, you know, the hard data and soft data relationship I was talking about earlier on. Credit spreads are a real big vector of that. And if credit spreads really were suddenly a lot worse than people expected, that would really drive recession risk and recession debt quite quickly. So it's really important to pay close attention to credit spreads right now and the credit market.
One of the interesting things about all this is when we're talking about the leading economic indicators continuing to decline, when you're talking about credit risks that are not being appreciated in the market, when the disconnect between the data that you track at Bloomberg, looking at bankruptcy filings, which are much higher than what the credit markets are appreciating. I mean, there's all these different things out here that are lining up for recession, and yet it seems that overshadowing all of this is the fact that the U.S. government is just spending like a drunken sailor with, you know, $6 trillion in U.S. federal spending. And so that's helping to just paper over a lot of these issues, especially when you consider the fact that, I mean, the amount of spending currently that's taking place is what we typically see within the context of a recession.
Yeah, I mean, it rightly point out, I mean, it's a huge fiscal deficit, you know, way bigger than you would normally get unless you're in a recession or in a war. So I certainly think that's been inhibiting the Fed's transmission mechanism for its interest rate rises. And on top of that, another aspect of that is that the Fed is still warehousing an enormous amount of duration risk on its balance sheet, which is another thing that's softening the blow, I think, of interest rate hikes. Do I think you could avoid a recession altogether with these fiscal deficits? Obviously, it reduces the risk. But it also, you always have that underlying risk of the fiscal cliff. And it wouldn't even be a cliff necessarily now. You go from -7.5% deficit to -4%, which is still a huge deficit. But as far as the markets and the economy go, that's a major fiscal cliff. So you could certainly still get a recession. Whether it can be a super deep recession or more likely to be one, probably not. But as I, you know, referred to earlier, you certainly can't rule it out. And I think it's a bigger issue here, really, in terms of, we now seem to have governments, not just in the US, that are willing to run perpetually large fiscal deficits outside of downturns. And it's really this, if you like, the existence of a, or the coinage, if you like, of a treasury put. You know, we've had the Fed put, which we had for many of the years after the GFC, and that essentially underwrote financial assets. And now we have shifted because, you know, traditional or sorry, quantitative easing and normal monetary policy kind of ran out of road. Governments started spending. Central banks still had huge balance sheets. The result was inflation. But if you have governments where the expectations of them now are much higher, and that, for instance, the pandemic, I think, hugely changed what regular people expect from their governments and what they expect to be covered. It's not just, you know, it's job loss, it's disease, it's health, it's a whole manner of things, which is going to make it very difficult for governments to kind of get back to maybe running much smaller deficits. So this treasury put is inflationary, because if you have governments running, you know, persistently large fiscal deficits, which they will have to be partly helped by their central banks to do that, that combination is very inflationary. And so where the Fed put protected financial assets, I'd say the longer term impact of the treasury put is that real assets are going to be the ones that, that outperform financial assets. In inflationary environments, financial assets tend to do, you know, tend to do quite poorly. Whereas you look at real assets, which are extremely cheap relative financial assets, like on a multi-decade basis, they tend to outperform financial assets. So I think there's a real key sort of very macro change again that's kind of happening under our feet that hasn't been fully appreciated by most.
Okay. And I think that leads to my last question, which you just basically touched upon here is, you know, what are some of the investment implications given your outlook and what we discussed today?
Yeah, 100% real assets, I think, will outperform financial assets. Now, that doesn't help a lot of big managers, of course. You know, financial assets absolutely dwarf the size of the commodity market. So that's going to be a real issue. So I looked at this recently. You know, I think as I mentioned earlier, the stock bond ratio is one of the most important ratios in finance. And now that stocks and bonds are correlated positively, they tend to be moving together. I think that's going to create a lot of kind of chopping and changing. So, you know, what do you replace your bond, your treasury allocation and your traditional kind of 60-40 portfolio? You know, if you look at it, there's really no good alternatives. In terms of risk-adjusted returns, the only one that really provides a better risk-adjusted return on a 60-40 basis is substituting corporate bonds for your treasuries. Pretty much everything else, you know, whether you look at commodities or gold or just holding cash, you know, none of these things really come up to scratch. So you're kind of left with a whole bunch of bad options. And it might just be the case, you know, especially now in a positive correlation environment, when stocks and bonds are positively correlated, cash tends to be much higher. So you kind of be looking to maximize your returns if you're running these sort of multi-asset portfolios. And you might just think, you know what, the best option here is just to buy more equities. So that could be one consideration or one outcome, if you like, of this new environment. Obviously, that's not great for long-term financial stability. If people's concentration risk is risen and they're in more equities. But again, that's something if you're reasonably good at market timing, that's something you can try and incorporate into your trading. But I think that's going to certainly have a big impact. And as you say, if you don't have any sort of institutional constraints, then real assets, like if you look at the 70s, they did very well. And I don't imagine, I don't see any reason why it should be significantly different in this regime here, where we're in an elevated regime of inflation regime. So real assets outperforming financial assets. And obviously gold tends to do well in that environment as well. So I think they're the main things. But within stocks as well, I would say, you know, again, right now the market's not trading as if inflation is going to be a problem, because a lot of high duration sectors like tech are still leading, whereas energy, which is, you know, much lower duration, tends to be lagging. So I still think we could see like a much bigger re-rotation, because at one point energy was leading, you know, back in 2021 sort of time, re-rotation into lower duration stocks like energy and utilities and away from things like tech. Again, all depends when the penny drops that this is not the environment that we're used to.
Well, Simon, I want to thank you for coming on to our show again. And just to summarize some of what you said, you know, recessions happen when hard and soft data weaken at the same time. That is happening currently. And you believe the recession risk is a bit higher than what the consensus expects. You do think that we're going to see a bit of a reacceleration in inflation. And again, the consensus is really thinking that we're going to see a return to what we've seen in the past few decades, but we should be thinking more along the lines of the 1970s. Of course, history does not repeat, but it does rhyme, as Mark Twain said. And, you know, one of the things that we can look at that is a risk is credit risk, not appreciating the level of bankruptcies that we see currently. So if we do see a repricing of that could lead to more downside, something that we need to keep on watching. When it comes to the investment implications, real assets you believe will outperform financial assets, especially given a number of the charts and things that you outlined in today's show. Part of that may also be with the stock bond correlation here, that, you know, investors, large institutional investors, are going to be reweighting their portfolios more towards equities. And alongside of that would be equities that have some exposure to real assets. Does that about cover some of the main points of what we discussed today?
Yeah, that's perfect. I mean, I couldn't put it any better myself.
All right, perfect. Well, I'm glad that we were able to get your view for our listeners today. You know, as we close, what would be the best way for our listeners to follow some of your excellent research?
My research goes on the Bloomberg Terminal. Column I have twice a week is called Macroscope. And I also go onto the Markets Live blog and I contribute posts to the called MLIV blog on Bloomberg.
Perfect. All right. Well, once again, we've been speaking with Simon White, macro strategist, Bloomberg LP, also co-founder of the institutional research firm Variant Perception, and definitely highly recommend you follow his work at Bloomberg if you get a chance. Simon, it was a pleasure getting your view, and we definitely look forward to speaking with you in the months ahead.
Thanks for having me.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.